5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff.
Hey there, Earthlings. Welcome to another episode of The Danny Project, brought to you by Neo Abilities. I am your host, Tessa, and I hope you grab your aluminum hats because we're on another exploration into all things disability. If you enjoy what we're doing here on the podcast and would like to have access to some more exclusive content, please be sure to check us out and join the crew on Patreon.
Discovery, go at throttle up.
Hello, you all. Welcome to another episode. This is Tessa. Today, we're going to be talking about something a little bit different, a little bit more deep and heavy, but it's super important to talk about, and it's really needed. There isn't a whole lot of information, and there isn't a lot of discussion going around about this topic. So, we're going to be talking about disabilities and reproductive justice, reproductive rights, sexual freedom, all of those types of things today. We all know that Roe versus Wade, it might be overturned. With such a big decision hanging in the balance, I really wanted to take a deep dive into how disability is related to the conversation that the world is having right now. Reproductive rights and justice and sexual oppression have long been a taboo subject in our society. However, those with disabilities have faced their own discriminations and injustice in regard to reproductive rights and sexual freedom. So, just a disclaimer, before we begin today's episode, it's important that I mention that we are just exploring the conversation around reproductive rights and disabilities. This episode is for educational purposes, and some might find this content a little bit too heavy. A trigger warning that we will be talking about SA, abortion, and other triggering topics, so please keep that in mind. If you feel like you need to sit this one out, I totally understand, and I look forward to having you back next week when we're talking about something a little bit more light. For all of you who wish to continue listening, welcome to today's episode, and I will link all of my resources in the description box below for you to look at if you're curious. The first thing that we should talk about is reproductive justice, and it is important because it frames a lot of what we're going to be talking about today. So, what is reproductive justice? It was in June of 1994, this group of Black women gathered in Chicago, and they coined the term reproductive justice. They, at the time, recognized that the women's rights movement was, we all know, is and was largely led by middle class and wealthy white women. They thought that this movement did not represent them well. It could not defend the needs of women of color or other marginalized women and trans people. These women found that they needed to lead their own national movement to uplift the needs of the most marginalized women and families and communities. They ended up naming themselves Women of African Descent for Reproductive Justice. And that's how reproductive justice ended up being born in the 1990s. Reproductive justice is rooted in an internationally accepted human rights framework created by the United Nations, which I think is so amazing. And it combines reproductive rights and social justice. They ended up launching reproductive justice movement by publishing in the Washington Post and Roll Call an 800 plus signature document, which was a full statement, and it ended up being a historic move. Then fast forward about 3 years, so 1997, Sister Song was formed, and it was created as a national multi-ethnic reproductive justice movement. It's a collective led by Indigenous and women of color. The Sister Song defines reproductive justice as the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy, have children or to not have children, and parent the children we have in a safe and sustainable communities. Their website, which is where I'm getting a lot of this information from, says reproductive justice is based on the United Nations internationally accepted Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This is a comprehensive body of law that details the rights of individuals and responsibilities of government to protect those rights. They also highlighted that reproductive justice is about access, not about choice. They mentioned that the mainstream movements have focused on keeping abortion legal and as an individual's choice. They said that that's necessary, but it's not enough. Even when abortion is illegal, men and women of color cannot afford it, or they cannot travel hundreds of miles to a clinic. There is no a choice where there is no access. Sister Sloan Reproductive Justice is not just about abortion. Their website reads, and I quote, "Abortion access is critical, and women of color and other marginalized women also often have difficulty accessing contraception, comprehensive sex education, STI prevention and care, alternative birth options, adequate prenatal care and pregnancy care, domestic violence assistance, adequate ways to support our families, safe home, and so much more." So you might be thinking what I was thinking, and maybe I'm just ignorant, but I wanted to know what the difference was between reproductive rights and reproductive justice. So according to a Harvard Law article titled "Reproductive Rights versus Reproductive Justice, Why the Difference Matters in Bioethics," it states that the reproductive rights framework is largely centered on achieving women's individualistic reproductive freedom through the legal system, thus focusing more on the legal system. In the past, reproductive rights has been largely focused on pro-choice versus pro-life debate and also on sex education and family planning. This article states, "Many believe that the reproductive rights movement hyper-fixates on the pro-choice legal advocacy, but it has overshadowed the, quote, socio-political and economic inequalities that are disproportionately faced by BIPOC women, hurdles that will be presented regardless of whether or not the right to reproductive care is codified through the law. In comparison, the reproductive justice approach, it acknowledges the way that socioeconomic status, gender, race shape reproductive health care and reproductive health care experiences and health policy. Reproductive justice also focuses on legal rights. However, it's not the only aim. There are several other aims, and it focuses on a more holistic approach. Its focuses include numerous factors that may serve as barriers to access, and the framework includes experiences of BIPOC women who have been burdened by poor access to effective contraceptive, forced sterilization, and environmental racism. The reproductive justice is a more intersectional, expansive, and holistic approach. And that's why we're going to be using it today, is because we want to look at the intersectionality. We want to look at a more holistic approach of how this topic is affecting those with disabilities. So when we look at Sister Sloan's website, they highlight four different ways that we can work towards achieving reproductive justice. The first way that they talk about is analyzing power systems. They say that analyzing power systems in the U.S. reproductive policies are based on gendered, sexualized, and racialized acts of dominance that occur daily. Reproductive justice works to understand and eradicate these things on a daily basis. They also talk about addressing intersecting oppression. Andre Lorde is quoted on their website as saying, "There is no such thing as a single-issue struggle because we do not live single-issue lives. Marginalized women face oppression, and we can only win freedom by addressing how they impact one another." It also talks about centering the most marginalized. They say our society will not be free until the most vulnerable people are able to access the resources and full human rights to live self-determined lives without fear, discrimination, or retaliation. This is very applicable to disabilities, the idea of self-determination and bodily autonomy, as well as autonomy in other areas of life, and not receiving discrimination or retaliation for that. And the fourth thing that they talk about is joining together across issues and identities. They say all oppressions impact our reproductive lives. Joining together across issues and identities, reproductive justice is simply human rights seen through the lens of nuanced ways oppression impacts self-determined family creation. Intersectionality of reproductive justice is both an opportunity and a call to come together as one movement with the power to win freedom for all oppressed people. So how does this fit into our conversation about disabilities and reproductive rights? According to a Berkeley Law article written by Mia Magnus, reproductive justice helps us to understand how eugenic science, which we will talk more about, is still a vibrant part of our culture and how it interacts with and shapes the reproductive lives of disabled women. Mia writes that the U.S. culture of ableism maintains that able-bodied people are superior, thus that people with disabilities are feared, hated, and typically regarded as a condition that in turn reduces the value of disabled people. She states that we can use reproductive justice to frame reproductive rights and disabilities. In this article, she brilliantly outlines five different crossovers between disabilities and reproductive justice. The first thing she talks about is the right to parent. She states that women with disabilities have a long history of forced sterilization or eugenics. They are often seen as unfit mothers and discouraged from having children, and they sometimes are not allowed to adopt. Authorities often make disabled women feel guilty about their decision to become parents, pointing out that their decision will take a toll on their families, children, and communities, or on themselves even. She also talks about sexuality. She says disabled women and disabled people in general are seen as asexual. And according to the National LGBTQ Task Force, asexuality is a sexual orientation where a person experiences little or no sexual attraction or desire. However, they state that this term is expansive, though, and may hold different meanings to different people and how they identify. Society also sees disabled women as dependent on able-bodied people. Mia argues in her article that this undermines women's access to reproductive health. In addition, disabled women and girls often do not receive the same reproductive and sex health education. Healthcare providers may also fail to ask women with disabilities about their sexual life, conduct pelvic exam, including screening for STD and HIV, because they assume that these women are not sexually active, or that they should not be sexually active. Mia also states that because disabled women are seen as having less than vulnerable or functional reproductive systems to carry out children, their reproductive health may go unchecked. A third thing that she talks about is the issue of access to services. So women with disabilities have a limited access to services and healthcare services and information. In a research article published by the Baylor College of Medicine titled Access to Healthcare for Women with Disabilities, they state that women with disabilities are less likely than women without disabilities to receive preventative healthcare and screening. This can include things like cervical cancer screening, mammogram, and prenatal care. In Mia's article, she also talks about the lack of access to transportation. So not only are we talking about access to the information and to health care, but we're also talking about access to the physical facilities. So lack of access to suitable transportation, mass transit, use of accessible cars, and then of course we're talking about the clinics and facilities themselves. Do they have ramps and braille, sign language interpreters, and is their equipment accessible? Reproductive health information may also not be accessible for women with disabilities. There could be issues surrounding language and interpretation, isolation due to levels of stigma around different forms of disability, a dependency on caregivers, and limited access to other women with disabilities who pass along information. Additionally, access may also be limited due to disability in class, for example, those who have computers and those who don't, or communication devices, or even mobility equipment itself can become a hindrance. Women with mental disabilities in particular also encounter barriers when it comes to accessing reproductive health care. They may even be institutionalized or vilified as drug users or addicts, and they also may not be allowed to have a role in the decision-making process regarding their own reproductive health and their bodies. So trigger warning for this next topic, we're talking about SA. So Mia also talks about sexual violence. She writes that violence against disabled girls and women is very common. In a 2017 article I found, United Nations states that women and girls with disabilities experience double discrimination, which places them at higher risk for gender-based violence, sexual abuse, neglect, maltreatment, and exploitation. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Women's Health, also cites that some studies show that women with disabilities may be more likely to experience violence or abuse by current or former partners. The Office of Women's Health also stated that women with disabilities can face abuse from caregivers and personal assistants as well. In addition, those with disabilities who need help with daily activities such as bathing, dressing, or eating may be at even higher risk for abuse because they may be physically or mentally more vulnerable and have different caregivers coming in and out of their life. Going back to Mia's article, she talks about power imbalances and isolation that those with disabilities may experience. She states that these things can create what she said is as a special vulnerability for those women with disabilities who become dependent on caregivers and can lead to things like domestic violence, sexual assault, and abuse. Caregivers and doctors as well may withhold information or medication, medical care, transportation as an expression of power and control. This perpetuates abuse and lack of access to reproductive care and information, perpetuates inequality, lack of independence and autonomy, and so much more that leads to oppression of those with disabilities. And the fifth thing that Mia brings up, which is a really great point, and it's a big topic in the disability community, eugenics and population control. She writes, and I quote, "The continuing power of eugenics throughout the United States justifies population control measures for women with disabilities and disabled children." She goes on to say that medical establishments pathologize disabling traits, associating these traits with social problems, and define them as targets to cure or conquer. Just there's this idea of needing to fix those with disabilities instead of it being a more normal aspect of life and building our society to be accessible. She states that women with disabilities have routinely been sterilized and maintained on birth control such as Depo-Provera. These practices have been convenient for caregivers and institutions, and that traditionally these projects of wiping out disabilities have centered on eliminating disabled bodies. However, today's inheritable genetic modification, or IGM, aims to modify the human gene pool to exclude genes that cause or might cause various disabilities. Then there is this use of prenatal diagnostics. While they can be good, they're also used to deselect and abort fetuses with disabilities, such as those with Down syndrome, spinal bifida, muscular dystrophy, sickle cell anemia, and many more. Many disability advocates and members of the disability communities say that these practices are deeply entrenched in ableism among women and the culture at large. So there are some opposing views when it comes to this, and this is a very sensitive topic. On one hand, with pro-choice, typically able-bodied feminists arguing for the right to abortion itself, yet many disabled feminists question the inherent ableism that surrounds the decision to abort. It is important to reflect on where human rights lie and how ableism may impact social justice or human rights issues such as abortion. So with all of that in mind, if we truly want disabilities and reproductive rights or reproductive justice, it is important for us to at least have a basic understanding of what the background and history of disabilities and reproductive justice is. So if you talk to other disability advocates, one of the common topics that come up is eugenics, as mentioned by Mia. Mia has stated in her article that eugenics or population control, in relation to those with marginalized identities or disabilities, violates the principles of reproductive justice. Although we are not going to cover everything about eugenics, it is important to talk about it in this conversation because it is a big part of disability history and the current situation in reproductive rights for those with disabilities and other marginalized identities. So the beginning of eugenics starts in the late 19th century when social Darwinism became more popular and people's acceptance of those with disabilities dramatically diminished. There is also a diminished respect and aid for those with disabilities. At the same time, society began to believe that more and more that certain behaviors and traits were inherited. Many people who were deemed as undesirable in a society such as criminals, those struggling with addiction and homosexuality were seen as taboo. Eugenicists justified eliminating the unfit, quote unquote, by citing the betterment of society. In the 1880s, the idea of creating better citizens became popular. Then specifically in 1883, this fellow Sir Francis Galton, the cousin of Charles Darwin, coined the term eugenics. In his book, Inquiries into Human Faculty and Its Development, he defined eugenics as the cultivating of race or science of improving stock. The idea of eugenics became more and more popular in the US and in the UK over the course of the Progressive period. These ideas were embraced by influential people, including scientists, politicians, feminists, and many others. We can see names like Alexander Graham Bell, Woodrow Wilson, Victoria Woodhull, and even Thomas Edison. Then, in 1907, Indiana, unfortunately, became the first state to legalize forced sterilization. This law allowed doctors to castrate or sterilize people in institutions against their will. They decided that these individuals were undesirable and defective. And then in 1909, California passed a similar law, and it began to snowball from there. At this time, terms such as mental hygiene, racial hygiene, social hygiene, and racial and human betterment became prevalent, unfortunately. And although they don't make sense in our current society, that's what was happening back then. By 1912, there was a book titled, and I'm not sure if I'm going to say this right, but The Calicat Family, written by Dr. Henry Herbert Goddard. And he was the director of the research department at the Training School for the Feeble-Minded in Vinland, New Jersey, USA. In this book, he warns of a rising tide, and I'm quoting, a rising tide of feeble-mindedness. He urges his readers to take action and to fight against hereditary taint. During this time, IQ testing and research into feeble-mindedness increased in popularity. At the time, the U.S. was setting into a trend of eugenics, and therefore it began to gain the world's attention. By the end of the 20th century, eugenics was so well-rooted in the United States that it was the status quo. Then we move into 1927. A Supreme Court Justice, Oliver Holmes, a supporter of eugenics, ruled in favor of forced sterilization of young women in Virginia. We see the case Buck versus Bell, where the Supreme Court ruled the state statute permitting forced sterilization of the quote unfit for the protection of health of the state did not violate the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. This ruling made eugenics federally legal. The Supreme Court justice stated that, and I quote, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." Then, moving forward to the 1970s, we know that more than 60,000 individuals have been forcibly sterilized under 33 state laws. It is important to note that the U.S. practice and research of eugenics would later be used by Nazi Germany, in which forced sterilization became illegal in 1934. Victims of forced sterilization include people labeled as mentally deficient, those who were deaf, blind, or so-called diseased, as well as minorities, poor individuals, and promiscuous women. Please note that institutionalization is a form of segregation. Supporters of eugenics originally sought to institutionalize those they saw as unfit during their reproductive years, particularly women. They wanted to keep them there to make sure that they didn't reproduce, and then these women were often let go when they had passed their reproductive years and no longer deemed as a threat to the gene pool. However, there are some drawbacks to this. Supporters of eugenics realized that it was expensive to segregate and institutionalize the vast number of people that they were worried about. Because of these drawbacks, they then turned to sterilization. In this process, they institutionalized people, then they sterilized them and let them go because they were no longer a threat to society. It is extremely hard for me to pin down current information on forced sterilization. However, according to my sources, in 1981, the state of Oregon performed its last legal forced sterilization. However, we know that forced sterilization is still happening to this day. For instance, in 2010, it has been said that California has forcibly sterilized people in prisons, and in 2021, they approved a budget for reparation for those who were sterilized without consent. So, what is the big issue and why is this important? Whether it be the issue of eugenics, sexual assault, access in general, access to reproductive information and care, and negative social norms, those with disabilities continue to face oppression in regard to reproductive rights and justice. It is important that advocates and community members alike recognize the importance of intersectionality and the historical implications that create barriers for those with disabilities. Reproductive health, education, and information should not be and cannot be limited to able-bodied folks. In doing this, we perpetuate oppression and discrimination against those with disabilities. It is important to recognize that disabled folks are sexual beings capable of sexual autonomy and independence and should be given the same freedom that anyone else has. As we near yet another Supreme Court's decision concerning Roe v. Wade, it is urgent that folks think about the implications of large-scale reproductive rights and reproductive justice issues for those with disabilities and among other marginalized identities. So as for Roe v. Wade itself, we know that in the 1950s, almost every state banned all abortions unless it was necessary to save the woman's life. However, in the 1960s, with the feminist movement starting up in women's liberation, the rules began to change. Because abortion laws started to relax, in 1965, the Supreme Court struck down laws banning the use of birth control for married couples in Griswold versus Connecticut. Then in 1967, 13 states opened access to abortion. At the same time, there were some states that restricted access, allowing the procedure only in order to save the mother's life. Texas was one of those states. A Texas woman, using the pseudonym Jane Roe, challenged Texas, and her case eventually went to the Supreme Court. She claimed that the law robbed her of her right to privacy and liberty as protected by due process in the 14th Amendment. Fast forward to 1972, the Supreme Court struck down laws banning the use of birth control by a single people. Then in a hallmark ruling, January 22, 1973, the Supreme Court struck down a Texas law banning the procedure. This ruling effectively legalized the procedure in the United States, and the court held that women's rights to abortion were implicated in the right to privacy under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Fast forward to today, we don't know if Roe v. Wade will still stand, or how the Supreme Court's ruling will impact our lives. So in the case that Roe v. Wade is overturned, what might be a risk, especially for those with disabilities? A statement released in May of 2022 by the American Association of People with Disabilities listed a great many reasons why overturning Roe v. Wade would be harmful for those with disabilities. The first thing that they talk about in their statement is that restricting access to abortion harms disabled folks, undermines the ideal of full participation enshrined in the Americans with Disabilities Act. The AAPD goes on to say that full participation in society is contingent upon the freedom to make one's own decisions, access to all forms of healthcare, including reproductive healthcare. Those with disabilities deserve unrestricted access, they say, to a range of comprehensive reproductive health care, including abortion, birth control, prenatal care, and delivery. Their summary also talks about the issue of abortion and disability. They state it perfectly by saying, and I quote, "We acknowledge that abortion policies have long presented complications unique to the disability community. Selective abortion is deeply rooted in societal ableism and eugenics. The complexities of our work teach us that restricting access to abortion is not the answer." Researching further, I found an article written in The Mighty where the author states, "The issue underlying abortion as a eugenic practice isn't abortion. It's racism and ableism that leads to forcibly removing consent and autonomy." AADP also says those with disabilities have a higher risk of pregnancy-related complications and maternal mortality. Both AAPD and Mia's article also talk about the greater risk of abuse, in particular sexual and domestic violence. Interestingly enough, AAPD also brought up the already over-criminalization of those with disabilities and the negative implications criminalizing abortion could have on the disability community, citing that overturning Roe v. Wade, quote, "poses great risk to the well-being of disabled people, especially especially disabled people of color, disabled LGBTQ people, and people with psychiatric, intellectual, and developmental disabilities. If access to abortion is legalized on a state-by-state basis, the lack of accessible transportation would make it even harder for those with disabilities to have the option. They note that criminalizing anyone who assists in facilitating with the procedure could also be an issue, such as sign language interpreters, personal care attendants, or assistants, and others could be charged with providing accommodation. Disability Justice, an organization which has an online resource center, has said, even though Buck versus Bell has never been overturned, so eugenics is still legal on a federal level, they say that its reasoning has been discredited and there is a growing awareness of the need for procedural safeguards to ensure the protection of the privacy right compromised by sterilization. Going back to the idea of reproductive justice and intersectionality, if overturned, there are several other rights protected under the rights to privacy, which could be overturned as well. Many of these rights protect other marginalized identities. The topic of reproductive justice is by no means just about disabilities, but I wanted to spend this episode talking about disabilities in particular because we do not talk about sexuality or reproductive health or reproductive health care or any of those types of things in relation to disability. Well, Earthine, thank you so much for sticking with me on this one. I know it's very controversial and I know it's a very complicated and heavy topic, but it's also a very important topic, and the important topics, even if they're uncomfortable, are the ones that are worthwhile. No matter what ends up happening in our country moving forward with reproductive rights and reproductive justice, I hope that you continue to think about how disabilities and those with disabilities factor into this conversation. How does ableism play a role in not only access, but in the way that those with disabilities are seen when it comes to how our laws and how our societies are built? We will be covering more topics of this as time goes on, but I'm not sure they will always be this heavy. As mentioned before, this episode is exploring the topic, and of course, please feel free to check out any of the resources or any of the sources I use below and dive into the topic on your own. I look forward to seeing you next time. Well, Earthlings, that's it for today's broadcast. As Carl Sagan once said, somewhere something incredible is waiting to be known. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and I hope to see you next week. Be sure to check us out on social media at New Abilities Everywhere, and use the hashtag TheDannyProject to continue these important discussions around disability. You can also join the crew on Patreon for more exclusive content. Until next time, peace out.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.